Well, hello, everyone. This is Pop the Left with Derek Varn, and I'm Douglas Lane. Say hello, Derek.
Hey.
We, this week, are going to be covering what everyone's been covering, which is the, what is it, a riot, an insurrection?
I think it's safe. I think you can call it an insurrection. It's too targeted to be a riot. It's hard. The coup talk, I think, is strong.
An attempted coup, maybe?
I mean, I would say some people in that crowd, yes, were attempting the coup. Some people were not, and that's part of what makes it very hard. Because for a coup, it acted a lot more like a riot. And so insurrection's kind of splitting the baby. It's also unclear what Trump thought he was going to do by both. I mean, I listened to the speech he gave beforehand and what he said on Twitter. And even before stuff got violent, he was trying to have it both ways, including saying he was going to go down to the Capitol building with them and then instead going home to the White House.
Yeah, like, that's typical Trump. But I don't know what Trump thought would come from the protest. Apparently, he knew at the time that Pence was not going to do anything, although I'm actually unclear as to what Pence could have done.
Pence could have refused to certify. It would have just stalled the entire process. I mean, that's all it would have done. Ultimately, it would have probably things would have played out the way they are now anyway. But except we'd be still dealing with that element of it this week. You know, I have a lot of theories. Even the day of, I talked about how it was weird how the National Guard had not been mobilized when it had when it had for BLM, when it was on standby for the Kavanaugh protests. And I think what happened, honestly, was that a lot of people thought that all but what happened would have been good for everyone's political optics. It would have scared the right people on the Democratic side. It would have, you know, been an intimidation against the rhinos on the rhino side. Everybody could have used it as long as they didn't actually get past the rotunda. Like that is when things really got out of control. And you will notice that's when shots were fired too, is when they went into, when they realized that, you know, people actually were believed what they were saying.
Right. Well, I just want to point out when the National Guard and BLM, my memory, and tell me if I'm misremembering, is that the National Guard was a little bit slow to come out in the original protests in Minneapolis.
Yeah, okay, but not at the Capitol. Nobody was allowed. No, right. Like, so I'm just comparing apples to apples here. They were preemptive at the Capitol. They've been preemptive at the Capitol before when there were massive protests.
And there apparently were some attempts to get the National Guard to be on standby that were refused.
Okay, so here's what's interesting. They weren't entirely refused. And the stories behind this are, depending on which part of government spoke, are conflicting. On the day of, there was reporting that the DOD in the prior day had, on the mayor's request, the Department of Defense had approved the National Guard being deployed as preemptive force, just to be there like they had at the Capitol, not the Capitol protest, the White House protest, same argument. That was slow rolled out that day and only afterwards. Now, the police chief says that the Senate and the White House together put the kibosh on it. The DOJ initially said that the kibosh was put on it by the DOD initially said the kibosh was put on it by the Department of Justice. Although there was another report that said that it was slowed out by Trump appointees in the Department of Defense. I just read something on the Washington Post that talked about it, and it does seem like there were people in multiple agencies both approving and denying at the same time. So again, I think people thought that it would get to a certain point and no further. And
what about the Capitol, the police, the Capitol police there, and the reports that came out that maybe they had let the rioters in? They let the
10 people. I think 10 people have are under investigation for aiding and abetting. 2 people have been arrested for it. However, some of what, and I've talked about this on other podcasts, some of what people claim was aiding and abetting is actually de-escalation techniques. For example, the take selfies with hostiles. That's something that I actually, know is part of de-escalation training. If you get the ability to take a non-hostile action, you take it. Mm-hmm. To calm the crowd down. It was also attempted many times in BLM. Like it wasn't unique to this, but apparently there were officers who were sympathetic who did something. I mean, all this, the investigations are still ongoing. There are 10 people being investigated that I know of. And like I said, 2 arrests that I know of. The day of, just to put the arrest in perspective, because people are like, no one got arrested for this. The day of, 14 people got arrested. 2 days later, 40 people got arrested. 3 days ago, 120 people were arrested. They are at minimum being in charge with a list of felonies that include, breaking and abetting, vandalism, and theft of federal property, most of which will land you up to 10 years. However, the DOJ is actually building a case for insurrection and sedition and conspiracy charges, which are much more serious. I don't know, actually. I'm going to talk to a lawyer this weekend for the channel to get more information on what all that actually means. But it does make it odd for me for all these calls for additional domestic terrorism laws, new ones, in addition to, all the other ones. Mm-hmm. Because it looks like we can throw the book at a lot of these people now. While I will admit to, I am worried about the resurrection of sedition laws, because people have pointed out we don't use, they apply a lot more than they're used. They're actually rarely ever, insurrection and sedition laws are rarely ever actually thrown at people. They were threatened to during the summer, actually, at a lot of BLM activists. I am worried that we're setting precedent for that to be expanded, but I will say it's hard for me to cry about, these people being charged to the full extent of the law. I'm not that soft hearted.
Right.
But I do worry about this push when we can already charge 120 people at least with things that can land you 10 years in prison, and a lot of these can land, and some of the stuff that they build the case for, it can land you for a whole lot more. It doesn't seem like we need massive expansions of law here.
Well, I'm wondering just what additional laws would be put in place to target domestic terrorism that we don't already have. I mean, like at the moment, if you're suspected of terrorism, domestic or otherwise, I think you can be locked away without recourse to process.
If you're a foreign national. So this is where things get complicated. Where you're a foreign national within the U.S. or anybody outside acting outside of the U.S., yes, you can be locked away, but not internal to it. The actual category of domestic terrorists is really, really hard to apply to a U.S. citizen within the country. I looked this up. So that's actually what's been sparing a lot of people so far, actually, from not just with this, but also with BLM and whatever, because there are a lot of people could have been hit with domestic terrorism for like burning that police building down and all those other things. I mean, there's many things that have happened throughout the year that you could have hit with it. If it was easy to charge U.S. citizens within the U.S. as domestic terrorists. The other thing that it would do is changing those categories, because I think that's all they would do is expand the category to apply to a lot more things. The FBI right now has a very, very hard time proving that someone meets the criterion to be a domestic terrorist threat. Nothing that happened this in the last week actually rises to the legal definition within the United States. And again, if you're outside of the United States, the rules get different. And that's because of the Patriot Act. So
I remember in the 90s, and I knew people who were part of the environmental movement and even worked with someone who had been involved with the destruction of like a bulldozer, like setting it on fire. And he went to jail for a while and he was charged. He received federal charges and he had to, his lawyer somehow managed to keep him from being charged as a domestic terrorist, but that's what they were.
Yeah. Oh, the domestic terror charges were thrown at green anarchists a lot, and they were up to 2012. I was actually looking this up. However, the way the legality of a lot of this is dependent on whether or not your group has been labeled by the FBI as a domestic terror.
Yeah.
Group.
I think it's had been or yeah.
Yeah. So that there's a lot of like, if your group, then this, and then normally they actually drop a lot of these in prosecution because they're mainly an intimidation tactic. But I have read
Earth First. Was Earth First considered a domestic terrorist organization?
Yeah, I think Animal Liberation Front was, Earth Liberation Front was. I don't know if Earth First was. I think maybe it was. There was a lot of crackdown on green stuff in the 90s and aughts up to the beginning of the Obama administration. Mm-hmm.
Was Clinton. That was Clinton, by the way, who put that stuff through. Bush and then Clinton. Bush Senior.
Right. So this has been building up for a long time. The other thing that you have to think after the Patriot Act is the expansion of material support laws. So, for example, if a local BLM group got declared by the FBI or, you know, the federal government to be a domestic terror organization, donating to a bail fund would be material support, and you could go to prison for 10 years just for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the expansion gets more and way more worrisome. I don't tell people this to, like, scare them, but there's a reason why you don't throw the word. Terrorist inflation has become a weird thing, and it's been a weird thing that I've even seen from Democrats. I'm not going to say the left, but I have seen Democrats arguing that, like, the war on terror wasn't a bad idea now. Because, you know, we got bin Laden and this, that, and the other. And it's such a reversal from even moderate Democratic opinion not that long ago. And so that's concerning. The fact that while I got no sympathy with people, you know, with Donald Trump being pulled from all these platforms in some ways, I want to point out that it was essentially arbitrary when and how they've done it, because every one of these things has been in violation of these, you know, norms clearly for a long time. And when I pointed out to people, there is literally no way for them to enforce the norms of the service agreement consistently. It can only be done by reporting and by algorithm with keywords.
Mm-hmm.
That people that just look at me like, and they're like, you can't do it fairly. And if they did, a lot of these are so broad that like most of their user base would be banned. Like, you know, I've never called for, you know, violence or shared things that I knew to be fake news, but I know that I probably accidentally violated user agreements more than once, probably for a guillotine meme or something, like our gulag joke. Mm-hmm. I mean, so all these things are worrying trends. Now, I don't know. I mean, you and I care about the platform one because it affects our income.
Yeah,
but it is kind of it's the thing that you hear the most about. It's actually the least important of these events, but it does concern me that this goes even to stuff like payer processing.
Yeah.
So you could be shut out of livelihood arbitrarily. Now, like, okay, so we don't want this kind of speech. You don't want, you know, certain stuff on these private platforms, but we don't have, there's no due process. And I have no way of there being due process because it's not in one nation. Like, there would be immediate problems if large parts of the internet are regulated only by the United States or only by the EU. And there already are issues with that, actually. But that, like, trying to handle all those rules seems to be pushing all this whole technology to capacity. It wasn't designed with nation states in mind. There aren't easy answers on any of this.
Yeah. Well, there isn't. There really aren't any easy answers. I do think that when it comes to the deplatforming of Donald Trump, I worry about the ramifications of that tactically. Although, on the other hand, it could just work. But if I were a QAnon person, and I was watching the news and seeing what was happening, and watching the banks separate from Donald Trump and watching all the digital platforms separate from Donald
Trump, including his email server, which I found hilarious, but like, right. Yeah,
I would decide that I think it would, I mean, I would decide this anyway, if I was a QAnon person, but I would certainly feel like all these actions only verify my convictions. Right. I mean so I wonder if, there's a risk of making Trump into a martyr, if he might come back stronger. I don't think it's likely.
I think the Trump part of Trumpism may really truly be dead. Although, you know, I don't want to die on that hill yet, but yeah. But the floodgates this has been opening that finalized that, you know, I mean, in some ways, Doug, I come out of the world adjacent to this, you know, my time as a paleo conservative. I've seen these narratives build for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I listen to things that help me follow what's going on with Alex Jones. I know the difference between these different far right movements. They're not unified. There's like several different conspiracy worlds, actually, that were involved in that insurrection that aren't even copacetic with each other. However, they are united in opposition to Democrats and to China, you know, which they link together in their head, despite the Democrats' hawkish, you know, talking points on it sporadically in the last year. And they are in a media sphere that is increasingly isolated. And part of how the stuff with Donald Trump happened, part of how, you know, Mach 1, which was all, you know, and I'm going to talk about the mocks on this, the alt-right, which, you know, everyone's like, oh, Trump and the alt-right. Well, the alt-right mostly went away. They were still people. They were, some of those old people were there on Wednesday. I saw some familiar faces and some photographs. But Proud Boys was Mach 2, which moved from out explicit racialism into national chauvinism, but it was deracialized, the whole. If people have studied Brazilian integralism, it's the same model. So you don't actually celebrate whiteness, but you celebrate Western culture, and you do so in a way that it, you know, like basically you can renounce your race, but you know, there's nothing wrong with being black. It's just acting black, basically, is that model. And then there's the Q model or the conspiracy model, which has been a part of the right-wing world since the Birchers. So that goes back to the Cold War, and that's still part of the mentality they're playing on. The thing is, Q mixes all that with weird, like cargo cult, like religious tendencies and a total inability to know how many people believe how much of it, because there's so much you can or cannot believe. And you only have to believe parts of it to be involved. But I can tell you this. The Axios and Ipsos poll today indicates that despite the fact that the Republican leadership is distancing from Trumpism, 50% of the GOP base believes in at least some, if not most, of these conspiracy theories, including that the election was. So that culture has spread throughout the conservative base in a way that I think we have been not looking at, because frankly, leftist culture is not treated quite as hostily by liberal social media platforms, and we have more access to it. And I knew this stuff was going underground, you know, in 2012, 2013. I don't want to crap on the dead, but you know, we had former comrades who have departed from this world, who had moved into that world after stuff going wrong with Occupy, after Mark Fisher, mm-hmm. you know, after the great Mark Fisher debates. I think of just a list of former comrades, but one really important one who went into that world, and I knew that they were.
Did he go into the world of conspiracy thinking?
Partially. He never went Q.
Well, yeah, Q was kind of rose up after he died, even I think. Or
no, Q's been around for about 2 years, but he was into the Alex Jones world. They were taking Pizzagate quasi seriously. Like it wasn't that they believed all of it. It's that there was the rational core of it. You know, like those of us who remember Truffer world, like there, I remember like when I never completely trusted the 9/11 commission. And so in the early aughts, Trufferism, you know, had some appeal to me because I knew the 9/11 commission was fishy, whether it was protecting people from Saudi Arabia or hiding the fact that maybe there was more intel than they let on. But it's a huge jump to go from there into full blown conspiracy world, but it's also attractive because you can get to the edges of that, from normal stances. And you and I have been talking about conspiracy world for a long time. This is not something new to our discussions. We did Pop the Left.
But this is the first, I mean, look, but conspiracy world seemed to me up until now to be a diversion for the left, like and also a path towards the right,
but it was a path towards the right.
Yeah, right. But it did not seem to me to be the engine of civil unrest before now. It seemed to me to be fairly like, you know, like people would believe that the World Trade Center was destroyed by our own government, but they wouldn't storm the Capitol, right? That and now we have, an insurrection based on wild and, you know, easily checked claims. I mean, the wild claims, the wildest ones I heard was one about how there's a secret cabal of deep state actors who have a yellow cube that can predict the future and help you change the timelines.
Well, there's also the pedophiles are also demons, like, and stuff.
Well, yeah,
like
no,
that.
The pedophiles use it,
right?
Use the cube, which I imagine to be something like a Rubik's cube.
Well, here's the thing,
I mean, that kind of thing is behind now. It's not the main thing, but it's that kind of thinking is behind this insurrection. And the other thing is that. I wonder where or how this information is spreading and whether or not it can be shut down. I mean, I don't think that we should try to shut it down necessarily. I don't think that's the best way. I think sunlight is the best approach. But I mean, what's going to happen next to fight domestic terrorism? Are they going to just read all our emails? And if you're talking about this kind of shit, you're canceled, or
no? We're going to be Minority Report territory. I don't know. And the one thing I will tell you is that, I lived. I'm going to tell a story about Egypt, and actually, I've talked about it on some other things.
But since you've been talking so much, I'm going to just give you the screen for a minute. Then,
all right,
here you go.
You can take a break. in Egypt. The government highly regulated the internet. It highly regulated sources. Like I remember when Al Jazeera, which in Arabic is not nearly as liberal as it is in English, but was opposed to the Egyptian government because of a complicated web of Middle Eastern geopolitics, just disappeared one day I could access it one day and the next day I couldn't. And, you know, there were certain words that I didn't mention even on Skype, even in English. And I sure as hell didn't mention them if I knew them in Arabic. I didn't know if anyone was listening to me, but I knew that my stuff was pretty well, like certain times of the day my internet would cut out. Some of it was like during prayer time, cause they wanted us to pray. But some of it was also, you know, during like the week after the April church bombing, which reinstated the national security law. None of that stuff went away. It just went deeper underground. And the government there was able to use it to reinstate everything that had been undone by the Arab Spring. So not, you know, I'm not just talking about, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood, because the Muslim Brotherhood was not super popular in Egypt by the time that I was there. But, you know, they were back under the same national security law, except now they were worse off for it because they didn't have any kind of tourism economy anymore because of the panics after the Arab Spring. People who knew the region actually predicted that this would happen. Now, why do I tell this story? Because there was a feedback loop between terror events and the federal government in such a way that the federal government could get what it wanted from the occurrence of from terrorist events. So, for example, that church bombing, the church was under-securitized. And Al-Sisi's government knew it, which made it more of a target on Palm Sunday. And then when it was hit by a split off of the Brotherhood that had taken affiliation with Daesh, ISIS, you can guess where it went. They immediately were able to reinstate the national security law. And of course, it drove certain people in the Egyptian society into a conspiracy theory that the government had propped the whole thing up to reinstate the national security law at the expense of 40 cops. Cops, C-O-P-T, not C-O-P. You know, I don't think it deliberately allowed it to happen, but I do think it under-securitized it because it was in its interest to do very little until something did happen. And then they knew they could do a lot more. And I worry about that with this, particularly after a year of unrest where the Democrats have been theoretically on the side of the unrest, sort of, but have also been talking. They've been talking about, you know, crackdowns and BLM for a long time. I promise you, stuff that was tolerated under Trump will not be tolerated by municipal and local authorities in the same way under a democratic national government. Promise you. Now, what does all this mean for us? I mean, you know, what how are we supposed to feel about this? One,
well, we were gonna go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah. I'll let you keep going. We were gonna talk about the kinds of quick hot take solutions or answers or explanations that you see proliferating around on the left, because this is after all Pop the Left. So I think we're in that territory now where, you know, asking what does it mean for a left project? What does it mean for socialism? I mean, obviously one thing that it means is if there really is a tightening of security and civil liberties start to disappear even more than they already have over the last 20 years, it means that organizing and for a radical kind of politics will become even more difficult, right? That you know, the reason why Marx supported bourgeois reforms was partly because it opened up space for radical organizing.
Right.
We should definitely fight against the curtailing of civil liberties for that reason alone. But what else? But that's not really a solution. but or an explanation, but it is something that's sort of obvious. But what kinds of things have you been hearing that you think that you are pretty critical of?
Well, so there's the two responses that I've seen is one that this is somehow an expression of working class rage. Now, I don't know. I tend to doubt people who say that that this stuff isn't prevalent amongst rural working class people.
It depends on what you mean by working class, right? I mean, right. If you mean people who are technically working class because they have a wage relationship in order to make a living, then it is an expression of some working class rage.
Right.
But if you mean a conscious working class that's organizing for its own interest, clearly it is not that.
Well, yeah, but I'm not even positing those two. I mean, like, look, I'm going to say something that might piss a lot of people off. But there is no working class politics where working class people are consistently working on one thing on a national level. There might be on regional levels. I'm not going to deny that. I've heard things coming out of Brooklyn or a lot of stuff actually in the upper Midwest and the cities that does look like there is something beginning to go on that is mass, but it is very regionally limited. It doesn't seem to know how to hook up with things outside of its region. Even when it works within the province of national organizations like the DSA. The amount of effort the DSA put into these campaigns, congressional campaigns, without putting into, you know, and yes, the DSA has begun to work with some of the unions, and particularly in the New York area, not any of the huge ones or anything like that. But, you know, so I don't want to give them no credit, but it hasn't been to coordinate stuff nationally. And it's been in areas that, frankly, you can run a shoe with a D on it, and it would probably win the area. Furthermore, they've been in flat out denial about some electoral trends. Oh, cool.
This is the other topic that we were supposed to cover. Jimmy Dore is doing.
We'll cover it in the
We'll do it in the parrot room.
We'll cover it in the parrot room. Jimmy Dore is maybe doing half of working class politics, but only half. I don't want to blow smoke up anyone's ass, but you know, funneling everyone into a party that will not be able to break state electorability issues, like to be on a ballot in an equal way, run by a bunch of Gen X radicals, and I'm not talking about Dore here, I'm talking about people like Chris Hedges, is a viable alternative, is hokum. However, and I'm this is where I'm going to go on however, because I actually want to say I think Dore's right to be calling the DSA and the squad fuck off. I don't give a fuck about you.
Talk about Cobalt George might be a very nice person. We don't know.
I don't care.
Well, we are talking about Jimmy Dore. But
Jimmy Dore is absolutely right to be calling the squad out, and I actually even think more so the DSA on immediately abandoning their tactics as soon as they have an excuse to do so. And frankly, this is a bigger problem than even the Medicare for All debate, which even if you got the floor vote, let's say that we got the Medicare for All debate, we always knew that it was going to be weakened immediately, right?
You mean if we got Medicare for All passed?
No, just on the floor vote, just true floor vote.
Oh yeah, well, the idea was it would go up and it would not pass. And
well, I mean, my bigger fear was that they would figure out a way to pass something with that name on it that was utterly crap. Because, you know, that's actually like a more smart.
Wouldn't that be risking a lot, because you have Obamacare there, and if you're passing something like Medicare for All and you're calling it that, aren't you going to be entering the morass of Obamacare and getting weighted down by a very difficult legislative agenda unless you're going to do something radical like Medicare for All, or, you know, radical in some.
How would that not get bogged down in a difficult legislative agenda?
It might, but I'm just saying, like, if your goal, if you pass something just to call it Medicare for All, you're setting up all sorts of battles over what's already established. It seems to me that it would be much more likely they try to put something that was actually Medicare for all, which, by the way, isn't the most radical. You know, it's not like even what they have in the UK, but they would put something like that up and it have it be voted down rather than pass something that.
I see. If they vote it down, this is where Dory's right. If they vote it down, you have a policy that has 52% support in the United States, voted down bipartisanly, and it would become unpopular. However, here's where I'm gonna, like, this is where I do think, where I do think you run into some real issues about all this stuff. So not only do you have, I don't think people are really looking at how difficult it really is to do a third party without federal level, constitutional level reforms to allow for a third party, which if you're burning the Democrats, you'll never get. But I'm also going to say, without burning the Democrats, you aren't going to get shit, because even if the squad and Bernie and everybody was sincere, and trust me, I no longer think they really are. I mean, they're just fucking liberals. The center of the Democratic Party, from a game theoretical perspective, is always going to have more power because it can trade votes where the left wing can't, unless that left wing is gigantic. All right. Meaning that it's a majority of the party, not a minority of the party, not a wing of the party. It would already have to be a majority of the House and the Senate. And it would really have to be able to play at state levels. This would have needed to been going on for about 30 years, all right, to fully manifest in a way where the DSA could have done anything. So it overpromised from the beginning from a conventional strategic standpoint. And then, you know, you have the radical bait and switch. And that's been the case this entire time. There's been a way where, and I've been trying to point this out to people as a friendly critic of the DSA, where the DSA allows all these radical opinions to manifest within one group, separates out through federated local autonomy so that they can feel like they're separate from the federal, from the national organization, which is more tied to the Democrats. And yet, what's most of the money going to? You know, local dues may only go for local things, but like, scale that up. And so what do you,
I don't know, where is the majority of the money going to?
Well, I don't know how much money the DSA actually has. It's not entirely transparent about all that stuff. Two, you pay dues to the national when they, and the national, you know, or if you remember, like when Heather Heyer died at Charlottesville, the national actually had a lot of issues because while they could collect a lot of mutual aid funds and all that, they actually didn't have a lot of good structures to even have accountability on that. They eventually did. All that money did go to where it was supposed to go, but how it got there was a fiasco because the national organization just hadn't done anything even at that level of accountability before. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it goes into producing producing material and getting people to canvass. All right. So I don't think it's like the DSA is acting like a pack for the Democrats. I have no evidence of that. I don't, that's not like what the political packs of the AFL-CIO are doing or anything like that, which they kind of are. But you do have this way in which the DSA has been really pushing, particularly in its progressive strongholds, for canvassing for candidates who are directly related to the Democratic Party and defending them strategically. And even people who I normally are hard on the left. I saw Doug Henwood, of all people, start making excuses for why they couldn't do Medicare for all right now. And I was shocked because he would, like, during the ACA years, he would never made that kind of concession.
Well, I have things to say about Henwood, but I'll save it for the Parrot Room. But I feel like we should talk about the video that I put out about Dore and
people called you out for splitting the baby.
They called me out for saying that, Dore was, caught in the fantasy of the Democratic Party as a workers' party when in fact he doesn't.
He's not.
But what I, well, the, yeah, well, yeah, he is. But even though he doesn't think the Democrats, because he doesn't have a vision for a party that isn't structured like the Democratic Party to replace it. He wants the Democratic Party that he used to believe in to exist in another form somewhere else. He wants to take the progressive wing of the Democratic Party somewhere else. But I don't think the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is really markedly working class or more likely to lead to radical solutions than the center wing of the Democratic Party and or the center of the Democratic Party. So that's why he's still caught in the fantasy of the Democratic Party as
well. Well, I mean, while I'm not even going to disagree with you on that, it is to me pathetic that a Gen X comedian who happened to have the stern reality of cancer brought upon his life to be more willing to call our Democratic allies and the stupid pop front that we've been pretending we have with this.
Look, I'm not against what he said or even the, and I'm certainly not against him criticizing the squad. And I didn't mean to come across like I was critical of him for doing that. I don't think I said anything like that in the video, but I just said that neither Dore nor AOC really has a vision of that would count as developing a working class consciousness, and specifically in terms of Lukash from History and Class Consciousness and the standpoint of the proletariat.
Your recent obsession with Lukash, I think, is degenerative. But
I'm not, it's not an obsession, it's a choice to cover territory systematically over time. It's not a matter of embracing him as my new guru. It's like, this is what he said. So the purpose of raising all that is to say, okay, like I have critiques of Lukash. One of them is whether or not even the idea of working class consciousness, as he spells it out, as having to do with an understanding of the totality, is coherent or sensical. Does it hold up on its own terms? And then also, does it still apply to the world? And can it function in the way that Lukács wants it to, where it doesn't rely on any of these internal laws of capital? But rather is some a little bit more abstract than that, based on reification rather than commodity fetish, as Marx described it.
Right. So how voluntaristic is Lukács? And if Lukács is super voluntaristic, how is it true or not, basically? Right. Okay, you know, that's fair.
Well, it's not just is he voluntaristic, although that's part of it. Well, he's not voluntaristic in so much as he thinks that, I mean, it ends up being a kind of voluntarism because it relies on the psychology of the standpoint of the proletariat in relationship to totality. But it's actually saying it's determined by that standpoint. It's not just something you decide. It's determined by that standpoint, but not by material reality, by material conditions. Go ahead.
You know what my critique of this has always been, that leads directly into standpoint epistemology and directly into the kind of politics that got the new left into the problems it got into.
You're overstating. It doesn't lead directly into that.
It historically
led to that, but it didn't lead directly to that, because you have to abandon pretty much the arguments that Lukács makes about the relationship. Look, people who talk about standpoint epistemology today have no understanding or description of a totality at all.
That's totally true, but the people that they pull from, the Marxist feminists that they pull from, sure as hell did. And like, when you talk about any theory, including Marxism, I mean, most of the Marxism we encounter on the internet is beyond dumb. And it's beyond dumb because once you start reducing things into slogans and those slogans become mutually reinforced feedbacks and no one gets past the slogan, then you basically have a very easy way for an idea to hyper degenerate, and particularly when there's no material basis for that idea to really connect onto.
Well, this is what I think the critique of my Jimmy Dore video should really have been centered on, which was the fact that I can describe class consciousness as Lukács put it down, and I can say that it that clearly the politics of Dore and AOC are not aimed at developing a working class politics based on that definition. But what I can't do is point anywhere in the world where that's happening, that where we have an alternative to join in.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say about Dore. Is like, if you line up the parties that we have options for outside of the Democratic Party, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and you may be doing a video about this, so I'm not going to steal your thunder on this. Mm-hmm. But and you look at what Dore's proposing, what I think is sad, all right, is you have a Gen X comedian who is nowhere claims to be a Marxist, barely, I don't even think he claims to be a socialist. He just
calls himself a dumb fuck comedian, which I respect.
Right. And
oh, which just, reminds me, we have to talk about Cumtown.
Right. Yeah. Well. but he seems more willing to do the sort of radical, I'm willing to hold hostages politics, you know, electorally, not literally.
These days you have to clarify that.
Right. I know, that's why I did. Electorally, not literally, that even the DSA says it's going to do. Like, I think what changed my opinion on Dore, because I've followed him for a while, and most of the time his politics makes me roll my eyes. But when he started quoting the DSA's manuals back at itself, and I'm like, no, he's right. They aren't doing what they said they were going to do, and they've sold this for 3 years, and they do just expect people to drop it. And
but that was, I mean, like, that's not, I'm not saying that he's wrong to spell it out and to call them out on it. He's absolutely right to do that, but it, and someone has to do it. And we should do it on our channels more. We should target the DSA more than we do. But on the other hand, I never believed that was going to not be the outcome.
No, but you and I, okay, Doug, let's like self-criticize for a second. Okay. You and I this entire time have been like saying the quiet part quietly, right? Like we've been talking about, hey guys, okay, you support Bernie, but Bernie's not going to be able to do what you think he's going to do. It probably won't build these working class institutions either, but it's better than nothing, so we should support it, and the Democrats could probably screw that up. All right, and notice we just said everything, but we didn't emphasize like, hey, even your best plan is probably not going to work, and right now the stakes are getting higher and higher. I mean, I want to like lay the stakes out for why I'm very frustrated with these easy answers. Like, I got mad when Adolf Reed said the entire point of the Bernie campaign was just to build a working class politics in America, because I was like, well, you didn't. And the reason why I got mad about that is because, one, we're still focused primarily on these progressive areas that are the richest of the country. Yes, there are working class people in them. Of course, they're some of the most populated places in the country too. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the electoral map as a viable political strategy from conventional politics, it actually does very, very little. It's very corralled. And I think the DNC has known that the entire time. And that's why, like, you know, people who've been talking about the insider outsider strategy and pretending like the DNC wouldn't know what they were doing when they're talking about it openly, is sort of nutty to me. Like how did anyone think they could say this stuff about a pop front and pretend that they were going to be in charge of it and say this in public, right? In print, and think that the Democratic Party didn't notice. And maybe it didn't, but if they were ever important enough to pull what they were saying off, the Democratic Party would definitely know way before you got there.
Regarding the DSA and the squad, say, but right now the squad, well, at least AOC that I know, has come out for expanding the power of the state to censor
media. She did. I'll give her one bit of credit, and I don't want to give AOC a lot of credit, but I want to play like things as they are. She has said that the domestic terror laws are unnecessary.
That's right.
That's it. That's all we got.
We obviously have to hold all the Democrats' feet to the fire over civil liberties issues right now, but ACLU has been captured on this. the DSA, are they going to stand up? I don't think so. What is left of the left to organize around to try to exert political pressure?
Like I said, I keep on being told there's places where there's local pressure, and I do see some evidence for it. But this is where the structure of the United States is being ignored by people. Because a lot of places where there are pressure, where there's real like working class activism going on in the Midwest and in the South, these are in areas that are also at the state level, even if they're voting blue at the national level, are still Republican. And get this, like in Georgia, for example, there was some down ballot local stuff on that runoff that still went Republican. Mm-hmm. All right. Ilhan Omar's district. Ilhan Omar got underperformed.
Sorry, just ignore that. Yeah.
Ilhan Omar underperformed Biden because Biden was able to pull people in beyond the normal Democratic base, which Ilhan Omar has pretty much captured. And it's about 60% of the pop, or a little under 60% of her district. Biden hit about 80. All right. So what am I saying? I'm saying like these people aren't bringing new blood into the Democrats that can cause them negotiation.
Are we ignoring the good work being done in the unions?
Oh, fuck off.
I don't want to ignore that. I mean, if that's,
yeah, I mean, if Amazon unionizes, it will be one of the biggest deals.
Be great. You know, I forget Chris Small's back on to talk about,
but I want to point out to this, our boom of unionization in the last 4 years, including this one, has only increased unions from about 16% of the workforce to about 17% of the workforce. That's it. And for the vast majority of the country, they're in places where unions are so weak, their only function is to lobby the party that controls that state. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, there are places, urban places, where people are attempting social unionizing. So I don't want to totally shit on it. Real stuff is going on. But a lot of the people who are romanticizing this are either not in unions or they're overstating their gains.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's just typical of the left in general about every single thing we do. So it's not, you know, particularly a workerist thing, although I guess it is. But yeah, no, I mean, I also don't see huge, and like I agree with what you're saying about the union movement, but those are institutions that the workers can try to utilize. But I think maybe what we need to take in this moment is the utter defeat of the rise of socialism over the last few years, right? I mean, since Trump took office, say, the way that now, after the insurrection, there will be more pressure than we've ever seen to back the Biden administration, to rally the wagons, to create that popular
front. What did I warn you in 2017, Doug, that we were at risk of taking...
You said, don't swim at 2 hours after eating.
No, that's not what I said. I said that if we're not careful, we're going to save the center from itself. That we are going to buoy up by the appearance of movement, of the appearance of moving the Overton window, at the national level, we're going to, and even if there's real stuff going on at the local level, which, you know, in some ways I think there are, I keep on putting that caveat in. I think that caveat's important, but because we're focusing so much on this national shit and we're not doing anything, you know, we're not doing anything from this local shit, it's actually creating a cover for the national move back to the center. Like, what did we do? And people are like, oh, Bernie's going to get, chairman of the budget committee, which is important. Okay, fine. But none of those bills are going to get passed without either a couple of Republicans turning coat in the Senate Our Manchin and the most conservative wing of the Democrats signing off. That's it. And so even stuff like Biden's anemic recovery bill, all right, which is not even what they were asking for, you know, in the House, you know, a few months ago, one is actually endangered of being stalled by the impeachment. Mm-hmm. And two,
I heard that there is going to be $1,400 sent out after all, that Biden made an announcement or something, that there's going to be a push for
it. There's a push in his bill, and it seems like the compromise with Manchin that they could get this done. So we get 2,000 overall. However, that's still a pretty anemic bill.
Buy more wine.
If you're one of those people who's like, oh, 6 months back rent,
that's not going to do you a lot.
It's not going to do hardly anything. And it's not what most of the developed world has gotten. Like, and you know, I hate to say this, but like my MMT friends, right? They were more mad about that than a lot of the leftists were. I mean, I guess they are leftists, but yeah. You know, the Marxists left. I'm just, you know, and that's, but even then I was reading reports that even that $1,400 is totally dependent on like either Manchin backing down or Murkowski or some Republican flipping sides on the vote. And yeah, the Republicans supported it when Trump was around because Trump was making a big deal out of it. But now that they're burying that, who knows what they're going to do?
Well, here's the question that we should take up in the parrot room. We've been talking for about almost an hour here. Could the left media organizer itself? And I think we could organize her ourselves.
For what though?
We could create binders of bread tube, and organizers.
I mean, like if we had to organize bread tube, the first thing I would do would be a bread tube purge. Like,
if you had to organize anything, the first thing you would do is a purge.
This is why I deliberately don't ask to be in charge. It's like, get rid of all these. It's bad.
So I would say what we should do is, if we're going to organize the left media, we have to put the fellows at Cumtown in charge, and that's what we'll start with when we do the parrot room in what, about 10-15 minutes on our.
Sure. Yeah.
Thanks for everybody. We didn't get as far into this as we might have.
I'm too mad tonight.
Eric is angry. I am stunned and basically floored, and a shell of my former self. But I will rebound. I will be back, and in 2 weeks' time we'll cover. Gene wants to know if you would purge him.
No, I would not purge. I would purge you for sure. You know what I would do? I think I would put, I would make Jimmy Dore Iron Felix. That's what I would do. Like, yeah. He's got good purge instincts. I like that.
But before we go, someone says that they came from Cumtown, which is, just as a little hint for what we're going to talk about in the parrot room. What did you think of my Cumtown appearance? Did you laugh? Did you cry?
I thought the Adorno jokes were hilarious. I admit that I am surprise, a stick in the mud and do not understand that humor. I mean, I understand it. I just don't particularly find it funny. What I could say, Doug, I was actually surprised that they kind of implied your position was too bougie.
My position was not bougie, okay? Fuck that. My position was just that if you're an employee of YouTube, you should be able to organize for you to you know, have a process and have some rights within YouTube. That was my position. And they interpreted that as me saying if you were making money, which is part of it, but you know, but all right. And actually, I should have expanded it. They were kind of right in a way. I should have expanded it to include anyone who they are making money off of. Like if your channel is running ads.
Yeah, at all.
At all. And that would, and at this point that would include everyone. But I was trying to be practical because, you know,
you're trying to be practical. You thought you were talking to normies, so you went out practical, and then they're like, "Hey, Doug, why don't you be more radical than you are?" I'm like, Doug, you pulled an Obama. You went on Trump Town and you pulled an Obama.
Well, choose hope. Choose hope. All right, I'm gonna get out of here.